Hello, and welcome to the Games About Glory. I'm your host, Milo, and joining me tonight are Ricky and Gareth. Hi, gents.
Evening, Milo.
Evening.
I'm back from my Easter holes, but there's no Steph this week. He's over here, and after experiencing the delights of North London on Saturday afternoon, Stratford yesterday, he's spending this evening watching Brentford. I can only assume that Palace, Millwall or Charlton can expect to see him this weekend as he does a 4 points of the Compass football tour of London. Tonight we're going to be talking about the West Ham game that happened yesterday and the Luton game that happened at the weekend and, well, all of the news like we normally do. So should we start off with, well, with West Ham? You know, we always start with a nutshell, and our kind of roving reporter, Steph, sent us this.
Hello, chaps. In a nutshell, well, I thought it was a really good performance. We just lacked a bit of penetration, as we tend to, but we did control the game rather well. It seemed to me that Moyes settled for a point after about 70 minutes. You'd like to see us take a few more chances, a few more shots at goal, but from where we were sitting, which it's behind the goal in one of the most, least, I should say, atmospheric stadiums around, yeah, we had good control of the game. Yeah, we must remember where we are in the project, and it's looking really good. I know you don't like that term, do you, Milo? So anyway, I'm using it. Overall, not a bad point. Of course, we're disappointed with Destiny not putting it in the back of the net at the last minute, but there we go. All right, that's as coherent as I can be. So I'm going to go. See ya.
Just as an aside, the audio file for that was abbreviated when it was playing then, and it said Steph Hammers Nuts. it's a bit disappointing, really, because Steph had bought a ticket in the West Ham end for last night and then managed to get a Spurs ticket later on. I was quite looking forward to, you know, firstly, kind of his undercover report on the Happy Hammers, and also him having to be quiet for 90 minutes for fear of upsetting the locals.
Oh dear, I think his nutshell might have been a bit different if he had sat on the home end.
Yeah, yeah. With him frantically out of breath trying to run away from people, do you think? So, in a nutshell, what did you think of the performance? We've heard what Steph thought.
I thought, well, pretty much agree with Steph, really. It was nice to score an early goal, but and it was very disappointing the goal they scored. I think we played well. I think we controlled large periods of the games, and it just got a bit more, after about an hour, it got a bit more of an end-to-end ding-dong battle with them, and then it settled down into that kind of draw thing, really. I think the disappointing thing for us was that it was definitely a game there that we could have, was there for the take-in. I'm not saying we deserved it, but I think we would have deserved it. But I think a point was fair, really. I think we've played West Ham other times and they've given us a better game than that.
What do you think, Gareth?
Yeah, I was a little bit disappointed. I felt there were elements of the performance that were a little bit meek, that we didn't really take responsibility, and we may well look back on it in weeks to come as 2 points dropped where we really could have gone for it. But by contrast, the last away game we played was a real horror show at Fulham, and I thought for all the control that we lacked that day, we definitely had yesterday, and there were there are some really good corrections from sort of previous previous mistakes. Let me just go with an easier word. Weeks gone by that were fixed.
Yeah, I mean, I was really impressed with how we started. I thought for the first 20 minutes we were really, really good. And I suppose the game's kind of settled into a routine, didn't it, after a while. I agree with you, Ricky. I thought we controlled the game throughout. We were creating good chances, but I thought, you know, the early goal when we're getting in behind, that cross from one wing to the other, which is proving so effective for us at the moment. We didn't do enough of that, I thought, as the game wore on. A little bit disappointing that, you know, that bright early start and that early energy we weren't able to carry all the way through, I think. In terms of team selection, so Johnson, Bentancur and Van de Ven came in for Kulusevski, Saar and Dragosan. What did you think of the team selection? Is it what you're expecting?
I think we always expect that back four is going to be the back four when they're all fit and ready. So that speaks for itself. I think that definitely Johnson deserved the opportunity to start. I don't really want him to get this become this super sub mantle, because I think that probably takes away from what he can do for 90 minutes. So he definitely deserved the start, and look, he scored within 5 minutes, so that justified that. I mean, the problem we've got in midfield at the moment is kind of everyone looks better when they're not in the team at the moment, and there doesn't seem to be any one combination that works. Either that, or we're just evolving into a slightly different time in football where with five subs you can completely change your midfield three throughout the course of games. I guess that's where you're most likely to make substitutions, and we shouldn't really be thinking about what our starting 11 is, that actually maybe there's thought needs to go into what's our closing midfield going to be, or even what should our midfield be at the start of the second half.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. Sorry, can I just come in on that and then we'll go back to the team selection, because I think that's an interesting point. I think part of what we have to think about, and this kind of goes, I think, again, with some of the criticism about first half performances, part of our tactics, I think, is to wear teams down and then to take advantage once those, you know, because tired teams, you know, make mistakes, they leave gaps, and that's what our tactics are there to take advantage of. And so I think it's not a surprise that we're seeing, you know, pretty much the whole midfield subbed off, or, you know, you were quite often seeing those changes on, you know, the wide players. I think, you know, that's the reason for it. And I think the next step in this team is to have that kind of depth all the way through, so we can carry on doing that. So Gareth, I think you're probably right that, you know, the use of five subs is almost part of our tactics, I think. Sorry, Ricky, in terms of the selection for this game.
Yeah, just the selection. I think just a little bit on the defence. I think we kind of rolled Van de Ven over into this game rather than play him at Luton, because I think, without touching on Luton too much, I think Luton's threat up front doesn't really require the pace thing. So this game, and I think it worked well, because I think with Romero and Van de Ven, I mean, their main threats are Antonio and Bowen, and they can both be a nuisance. And I think on the large part of it, we dealt very well with them. I mean, Van de Ven was a little bit unlucky once when he actually did the right thing, but the ball coughed up right for Antonio to have like one-on-one chance. But so yeah, I can understand that completely, and I think they both did well. I mean, the midfield thing, yeah, it's not really clicking in any kind of combination at the moment, but I thought in this game, I think Bentancur, especially with Madison coming deep, Bentancur and Madison are both kind of almost ball players that want to get on it and then distribute. They're not doing the same thing, and they're not getting in each other's way or anything like that. But I think in this game, West Ham sometimes defended deep, but most of the time I thought they were a bit, they didn't really press our centre halves, and then our midfielders, they would kind of just create the lines of the pitch in front of them, like they had their three midfielders. And then I thought they were a little bit ball watchy, West Ham. It wasn't that hard to play in between those lines, I didn't think. And Suchek and all them were just kind of watching the person with the ball, and then sometimes we'd play it through. And I suppose you could argue that Bentancur and Madison are kind of maybe our best players to play those kind of balls in between the lines and trying to get us to move forward. And I think definitely in the first half it was working, because I think that was what was adding to our domination. But yeah.
Gareth and I were talking about this earlier on with, I think, you know, what West Ham were doing is similar to what Everton did against us, which is kind of passive press, I think we're calling it, aren't we? Where they're quite high up the pitch, but they're not engaging our players.
Yeah.
And they're trying to block off those passing lanes. Mm. And, you know, and then, you know, once we've got past that, that's when they're dropping back into a low block and, and making it very difficult for us to get through. But yeah, they were coming up the press, but like you said, standing off us. I mean, I thought in terms of the selection, I think Bentancur makes sense in the games where we're going to have more of the ball. We discussed this a few weeks ago, I think, last time we started a game. You know, Saar, you know, is great. You know, he's a great presser, really good at, you know, really good at running, covering ground, harassing and breaking, you know, slowing down teams, breaking them up. But when we're going to have a lot more of the ball, you know, he's not as good on the ball as Bentancur, makes less sense. I agree with you, Gareth. I think Johnson had to start after his second half performance against Luton. You know, Van de Ven obviously starts whenever he's fit. And I think, you know, like you, I think it makes sense, you know, considering this is his second hamstring injury of the season and it, you know, wasn't a major one. You want to really try and keep him, well, you know, you don't want to risk a recurrence, do you? You don't want him picking up another injury. So yeah, I think it actually made sense for him to, you know, sit out Luton, even if he was fit, and, you know, save him for this one, save him for the games we need him for. Mm. So yeah, I mean, it was pretty much what I was expecting. I think the only question mark would have been, you know, before the game would have been, you know, Saar or Bentancur, but I was kind of pleased with the decision he made.
Yeah.
Brennan Johnson's had a really good week. You know, obviously he came on, had a big impact against Luton, and then this game he scored after 5 minutes. How impressed were you, you know, in this game, you know, the kind of building kind of relationship between him and Werner, and I suppose his development under Ange?
Yeah, I think he's had a good week apart from not qualifying for the Euros.
Well, no, for Spurs. Yeah,
for Spurs, yeah. Sorry, no. Probably a little bit upset about that.
I'm very much, you know, club before country, even more so when it's even more so when it's not my country.
Okay. I think he's had a very good week, though. I think his confidence looks... He's just his demeanour is even more confident now. He really wants to run at people. It feels like inside himself he feels a threat now. In other words, and that's just bred from the confidence. And as you say, I think that's a really common route to goal now, that one side to the other side with the low kind of cross ball. And we've seen plenty of goal. I mean, in fact, it's like really is almost... slightly worryingly, our main route to goal most of the time these days, but it's effective, so why not? And I think the advantage he's got is he's very much plays to that kind of move, and I think that's to the detriment of Deki, that doesn't play to that kind of move. And it's really looking like Johnson is going to get well, at the moment I wouldn't see why Johnson wouldn't start most weeks this time, and if that means he shakes any kind of super sub thing, all good as well, because I don't think any players like that since David Fairclough, probably. Was it David Fairclough? Yeah. One for the teenagers, that's right.
Yeah, no. Again, I think similar to what we were saying about midfield, we also need to consider that subs are an important part of the game more so now. So, yes, you've got your classic super sub, David Fairclough. I always think of Paul Walsh as being our super sub from many years ago. But Johnson could be that, and maybe that's not a bad thing that he's got that in. But the way that we play, the way that we're set up to try and score goals, it's around everything being one touch in and around the edge and around the sides of the penalty area. And he does seem to be a perfect player for that system in a way that Kulusevski I don't think is. So therefore I think when we play well, Johnson's likely to be a big part of that. I do also think if we are sort of comparing other players on the forward line, I think where he is going to be better than Werner is that he has the instincts of a number nine. I'm sure as a kid he probably grew up playing as that central striker in a nine, and I think when he plays wide he gets into those natural positions, whereas Werner, for me, I know this question wasn't about Werner, is he often hides, he seems to be hiding behind defenders sometimes, that he's not saying he never gets in those positions, because I think when we talk about Luton, the own goal was largely him forcing that by being in the right position, but it just seems a bit hit and miss, whereas Johnson always wants to step across the first defender and get there on those crosses. It was very similar to the goal that he scored against Wolves, which was his first goal for us back at Molineux in November. That was a cross that came in from the right when he was the left-sided player and got into a centre-forwards position. So I think there's lots of positives and lots of pros from having Johnson in that front three.
Yeah, I think at Forest he did play up top a few times, not regularly, but I'm pretty sure he did play as a striker on occasions. And I think you're right. I think, you know, one of the things Johnson's got a over Deki, you know, apart from kind of what you've already said, and you know his willingness to go past a man on the outside, you know, that kind of low grubbing cross, it's just very difficult for teams to deal with. I think also he's a far better, you know, as you're saying, Gareth, back post presence than Deki. Deki doesn't tend to make those runs to the same degree, and it's, you know, as, you know, we've been saying, you know, one of our most effective routes to goal at the moment. You know, if we are thinking about him as our kind of first choice right winger, where does this leave Deki?
I think the problem Deki's got as well is I think in the long run we're going to want to sort of play people into positions as we flow forward across along the pitch, and I think Deki's definitely a man that wants to play a bit more of the physical game and maybe hold the ball up, and then it's almost as though he enjoys his own physicalness and then tries to angle players off that, as in the defender, he tries to leave them off the ball and that kind of thing. But all the time that's going on, there's some kind of like delay in the way we're playing, you know what I mean, while he's playing his own kind of game. And he has got good qualities like that, and it might suit some games, especially, I don't know, I mean, I suppose a low block might suit that a bit. I don't know, maybe not even then. It's just difficult to know where it leaves him, because the stark contrast between him and Johnson is there for everyone to see. And I think some of his, I mean, even just boiling it down to the cutting inside thing, is almost playing him out of the team. And I think we said before our chat that was even referenced by the manager himself in one of the post games.
After the Luton game, he said he took him off because Deki was coming inside too much, which is something that we've been talking about on this pod, you know, for most of the season.
Yeah.
And you know, specifically that change from playing with a back three and wing backs to playing with, you know, wingers now. So he's being asked to play, or our wide players are being asked to play, you know, out on the touchline with the fullbacks undercutting. It was the other way around before. Yeah. So, and that's not his natural game, isn't, you know, he was signed to play in that half space. And that's, you know, there's not the space there for him now. And I think you're right. I think the issue with the low blocks is, I think there's two. Firstly, him wanting more touches allows a team to get settled into a low block. Yeah. So that's not particularly helpful. But also coming inside, it means that his fullback can come inside. And, you know, part of the idea with this tactics is to try and stretch the pitch so that the opposition have to stretch out. Yeah. You know, if you're occupying the whole of the pitch, then your opponents have to occupy the whole of the pitch in order to defend against you. And that should leave gaps in between defenders. You know, a lot of these low block teams we're seeing playing with a back five, so they're pretty much matching up man on man.
Yeah.
And yeah, we you know, if we make the pitch narrower, then we're making their job a lot easier. I mean, I do wonder whether his future with us, you know, next season onwards is, you know, a rotational, you know, cover for Maddison, and we look to bring in, you know, more wide players this summer than we maybe thought we would have needed to earlier on.
Possibly.
And, yeah, you know, we look to bring in, you know, Werner, then probably two more. And those other two are, you know, both wide players who are happy staying very, very wide and very high and can take on and beat a man and get in behind. And, you know, I think if you know, again, when we're talking about kind of the five subs thing, I think that makes us, you know, very, very potent and, you know, very difficult to play against if we had, you know, four players who were able to do that.
Yeah, I suppose it depends. I'll just add, and then, sorry, Gareth. I suppose it depends on whether we play a really specific system with never, ever wanting to vary from that, if you see what I mean. It just depends. If you play a specific system and teams just keep, like, finding a way to resist that, then we would have to look kind of elsewhere. I mean, the advantage, I suppose, of keeping Deki is, in if he plays in the middle, is he can always play out wide if we need him to, because of a change of system or because of injuries or something. So, yeah, and I suppose he's the right age to keep as well, as in, you know, he's not, you know, he's still young. So,
and I think Ange is quite open to making in-game changes as well, isn't he? We see this quite a lot. You know, I mean, I think again, he made the point about Deki in one of his press conferences this week, where he's played, you know, on both wings, up top and in midfield this season. So he's covered a lot of positions, and we do shift around during games. So even if we made those changes, I still think he would play on the wing next season. It just probably wouldn't be his primary position. And if we're in Europe and, you know, we've got 60 games or whatever it happens to be, then having that option there is, I think, is really useful.
Yeah.
So what do you think, Gareth?
Well, no, I was thinking when I watched the game back today, watching it on Spurs play, Rob Daly, the first commentator, made a point midway through the first half of how West Ham were making the centre of the pitch so congested. And I think having Kulusevski out there today would have, in no circumstances, really would have been bad news. I don't think anyone would have gained anything out of that. I think the other times where he's looked really effective is when he's cutting on his left foot and he's putting some deep crosses to the back post. Now, I think if Richarlison's playing on the other side as an aerial threat, then maybe that would make a little bit more sense. But I think whoever we're talking about playing on the left of the front three, whether that's Sonny, whether it's Johnson or Werner, they're not players who are going to attack aerial balls that Kulusevski would be, in theory, capable of delivering. So I just, at the moment, with the way we're playing, you'd have to pick players like Richarlison in particular positions to get the best out of him.
Yeah.
And I think that becomes tricky, doesn't it? But with Son being captain, it's hard to see Ange dropping him, which then means you're looking at a front three of Deki, Richarlison and Son, which, you know, Son wants to come cut inside as well. So then we're making that, you know, the pitch very narrow with both wide players coming in and doing that. And I mean, particularly against teams that sit back, then we're making it easy for them.
And also, that's kind of then going against which seems to be our main route to goal at the moment. We do seem to score a lot of these kind of, you know, cross it in low and someone's just there at the back post. So, you'd be changing a lot to really hope to gain, you know, not much if you're aiming to score more goals than you are already. You know what I mean? So it's a risk. It'd be a risk, yeah.
You've already touched, Gareth, on midfield being a bit of an issue at the moment. So Benteke coming in for Sarr, it was Benteke's 50th performance. So, yeah, was it one of, I mean, let's talk about him. Let's talk about how he played, and then maybe also Maddison and, you know, how we thought he did, you know, how he's been playing since the injury, and whether this was, you know, I thought maybe this is one of his best performances, you know, since he came back from that injury. But I'd be interested to hear what you thought.
Yeah, well, first of all, my question is which injury? Because we've heard recently that he's also been playing with a broken toe, hasn't he, for a few weeks as well. Yeah, I think he gives us much better balance in there. I don't think it's a coincidence that we had more control of that game yesterday than we've had in a long time with him playing alongside Bissouma. He was quite heavily involved in the goal. I think he was involved a couple of times. So initially it was his little pass on the outside of his foot that unlocked a space. And then he went and joined in the attack. And it was, I think he then played the ball out to Udogie or to Werner. So he was certainly involved twice in the goal. As I said, really, I think all of our midfielders at the moment, they all kind of do all right, but no one really takes the scruff game by the scruff of the neck. I think only Saar's the only one who I can think of in spells where he's really, really affected a game from midfield at the moment, whereas others just kind of drift in and out of games. And going on to Maddison, I actually thought he was... The game started to get stretched a little bit more in the second half, and I thought that's where he started to become more influential. And I was... Well, I'd say disappointed he was taken off because I thought he was becoming slightly more influential. What we don't know is whether he's got 90 minutes in him at the moment. He was substituted for Kulusevski, wasn't he? So he came in and took his place in the number 10 role. But he didn't look happy to come off, though, did he, Maddison? And he didn't look happy to come off on Saturday either. His face always tells the story of how he's feeling. He hasn't got much of a poker face when he comes off.
I think this is probably the type of game that he enjoys playing in. He seems to me to be, you know, obviously he's very confident. He's, you know, he's cocky. A lot of the things that probably we disliked about him when he was playing for other clubs are what you like about him now. And he's the kind of person who seems to relish the attention of, you know, being being part of a game like this. So I think that probably plays into it. I think that also probably helps him get up for a game. But yeah, you're right. I think against Luton, he went straight down the tunnel, didn't he, after coming off?
I mean, I agree with Gareth's last point there. I was slightly surprised that he came off because it was just the game was starting to sort of turn in his favour from just having a lot more space, a lot more yardage around him as the game went a bit more. So I think I was a bit disappointed because I think West Ham actually came out all right in the second half for the first 5 minutes. And I thought, because usually we think Ange just had a word and then we'll stop. And then I thought, oh no, they're playing well. But then we turned it around. And as soon as it opened up, Maddison definitely enjoys having that more space because he can carry the ball a bit more sometimes and then pick his options. I mean, the one thing I would say about the midfielders are, I think Saar has been massively impressive this year, but in a kind of like penetrating runs way and trying to take the game by the scruff of the neck himself and just covering mileage. And of course, that's not Maddison's or Bentancur's game particularly. And I think the thing they suffer from slightly is if they do those kind of break the line passes, i.e. up to the forward line, one of Son's worst attributes is when he comes back towards the ball from the central defenders. He's not really technically that great. Mm-hmm. It does bounce off him. And I think he's just got that thing that people have where because they've got their back to the goal and they think the defenders are going to be there, they just feel that kind of sort of that presence of another player there. And sometimes it just makes them a bit twitchy with their touch when some players are just, you know, I mean, you pass it into someone like Bernardo Silva and he just doesn't care really how many people around him, those kind of players, they're just naturally talented. And I think Werner, I mean, we can play it to Werner, but then quite often he's not asking for the kind of inside the fullback ball or anything, usually just out on the touchline, then he'll cut back and then play it back inside. So I think if we had better play, I think Johnson's all right with this, though. I think, like we were saying earlier, I think when it gets involved in that more intricate play, I think he's got quite fast feet and fast reactions. So I have kind of more hopes for that Zim. And all I'm saying is that kind of is part of those players' games of like passing it on one, like through the lines, and then maybe going to receive it again. And I don't think the game kind of always... I don't think our momentum keeps on from that pass quite often because either Son might lose it or, you know, I mean, you see some other teams do it and they're just a lot more fluent with the kind of keep popping it to each other and that kind of thing. And I think we would, I mean, ironically, I mean, I keep going back to it. I mean, we had earlier stages in the start of the season where we did look like that. We were absolutely masters of just flowing forward. So I just think that kind of, that's a slight detriment to their game. And not detriment, but it just makes them not look as kind of impressive as they could be. Because I can't really remember, it's been a while since I've seen Maddison put something really like clinical in, like a ball where you, you know, think that well, apart from for England the other night, he did quite a good one too. But apart from that, I think there's more to come from them, and I think the more we get better, the more they'll get better as well. I was hoping it would be the reverse of that, that they, like players like them, would make us get better. In other words, they'd be the driving force, and I just don't think it's quite working out like that at the moment. I mean, we still should be grateful. I mean, our midfield choices are still look like they've got bags of potential, and they're a quality group to kind of choose from. So.
Yeah, it's not a bad position, is it, where you can talk about, you know, Saar or Bentancur or, you know, maybe even Decky or Maddison and not being too bothered about, you know, who's playing or, you know, who's coming on. I thought in this one, I thought Basuma had a really good game in this game. I thought, you know, he was very, 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 very comfortable, despite, having, you know, 2-3 men on him quite often.
Do you think that goes back slightly to the way West Ham played, maybe, or
standing off him?
Well, sort of standing off him a bit, but I just think that because, like, going back to the Fulham game, they would try and block the passing lane, but also press like crazy, wouldn't they? I think most teams would just want to follow that kind of blueprint, really. So I'm quite surprised, because West Ham showed that if you stand off us and try to cover spaces and stuff like that, what you really are going to do is just relinquish control to us, kind of thing. You know what I mean? So I don't know whether that helped Basuma in this game, because he had a little bit more time to think about things sometimes than that. I mean, I think he had a good game. I'm not disagreeing. I'm just wondering whether that was because of the opposition.
I do think there's been a change in how teams play against him since the beginning of the season. I think, you know, pretty much every game now he has two men on him, but you're behind him trying to block off that turn and carry that we were seeing a lot early in the season. And yeah, we're obviously seeing a lot of interplay between him and Romero, particularly with Romero passing to him, it going back and then going down the line behind, which is really effective. I'm seeing a lot of criticism for him at the moment, and some of that's from mistakes in games. And, there have been a few, but I think people are overlooking a lot of the good stuff he does and. Yeah, how important he is to our build-up play. You know, pretty much all of our goals are coming from very quick, play out of defence and down the lines and in behind. And I think he's so important for that. And I think I just think it's getting a bit overlooked, and people are focusing on, it's often the case once a player's been around for a while, people focus on on one thing, and that becomes kind of the preoccupation rather than looking at the, performance in the whole.
But anyway. He set himself very high standards, didn't he, earlier in the season? So that's the thing. What do you think Angie's thoughts on him are?
On Basuma?
Has he got any doubts about them? Yeah. Do you think he's got any doubts about him? Or do you think he's seen some of the things he does and then thought, I'm not sure,
I mean, in the press conference this, he said he thought he was excellent in this game.
Yeah.
I mean, Ali Gold has been saying that we're looking at sixes. My suspicion would be that would be an understudy to Basuma, because I think someone who's better than him is going to cost a lot, 70-80 million pounds, and considering we need probably to spend something in that region on a winger this summer, plus strengthening everywhere else, I just think that's very unlikely. So I suspect that we'll probably look at a young six with potential who maybe in a year or two's time might surpass him and be a rotation option, would be my guess. There aren't many of those players around. That's why they're so expensive. It's because, there aren't many. And, in this league, probably the only one who's better than him is Rodri. I think it was certainly his top form.
I mean, if you saw the way he played early in the season, you'd class that as, one of the best in the league easily, wouldn't you?
Yeah. And I think you've also got to bear in mind that, after that, he had that period where he had a booking away from a suspension hanging over him for a while, didn't he? Because he had that, and then he got two yellows in a game. So he actually served a one-match suspension and came back with the suspension hanging over him. And then he had AFCON and he got malaria. And there, there's been quite a lot has happened in quite a short period of time. West Ham equalised from a corner. We've changed our marking at corners since Vic was getting roughed up and bullied a few months ago. Have we solved one problem and created another, do you think?
Yes, I think that is the answer to that. We've done really well on corners. I'm just looking at my spreadsheet at the moment. The first goal we conceded from a corner this season was against Everton right at the back end of December. And that was the first time in, I can tell you exactly, in 118 corners we conceded a goal. Then we had the incident with Man City and then the Everton away game. And then since then, yeah, we've struggled somewhat. It was, well, I'm just telling him here, I think that's, yeah, it's five goals we've conceded from corners in the last 10 games, some of which are unavoidable. I mean, we always say corners are a low percentage thing, but by nature of that, if you know, if you concede 100 corners, you're going to concede three goals from them, you know, statistically. So maybe we're just seeing a bad run of those coming at the moment, having had quite a good run at the start of the season, and it's evening out a little bit. But yesterday was one that, yeah, it was, I, nine corners. I mean, the commentators kept making a thing about how, you know, nervous everyone at Spurs must be because they've conceded a corner. I actually thought we defended like majority of them really well. There was the one that they scored from. There was the other one that Vicario saved, but Antonio was offside right in front of him anyway, which would have caused a problem. But the other seven, I thought we dealt with very well.
Yeah, I think probably it's... I think it's the effect of that first one was just the carryover thing, because I was quite nervous every time I got one. But having said that, I mean, what you don't do really, one tactic you probably don't do is let just Kurt Zouma roam around in your penalty area with absolutely no one near him whatsoever. And I think Mavropanos, and they're both like really tall, massive people. And it's just a risky kind of tactic, because I think were we, with that one, did we actually have one of our people with Vicario, or were we just, because we were just kind of lined up in a line sort of 4 yards out, weren't we?
Yeah, kind of. One of the changes we've made to try and protect Vicario is to take the man off the back post and then put them in the middle to push people away. And Zouma on that corner starts off on the back post. So when he runs through, he's blind. Our players are blind to his run. So it's an odd one. It's an odd one. I think it would be Matt Wells, wouldn't it? It'd be Matt Wells who's in charge of defensive.
I think that's right. Yeah, I don't think
defensive
it's
set pieces.
It
so
I thought it was Mile Jedinak actually. Did I don't know. I've heard conflicting things, so I'm not sure.
I think they have said some of that in some of the interviews, but I can't remember who said it and who they were. Yeah, I think it has been mentioned in some of the interviews, but now you keep saying those names, I'll keep then wavering from one to the other. But I think I know this seems a bit layman's terms, but I just think basic football. But I think the two most likely people that are going to head it in the opposition team, can't we just like man mark them with someone that matches up well with them to stop them having any kind of free run? And then the rest of it can just be zonal. I'm happy to do the combination thing.
But you say that the last corner we conceded from was the one against Wolves at home. And was it Gomez who scored it? And so he's probably the least likely player to score from him. So
yeah.
Yeah, and so it can be counterintuitive sometimes.
Yeah, but I suppose the one thing in common was that he just had absolutely no one near him and he just headed it in. That was the thing in common. So there's definitely something going on that could be improved, but I don't know how we're going to go about that really, because I think Vicario definitely doesn't like the pressure too much, but that's going to be coming in this league. I mean, I've noticed it more now with other goalies. Now it was happening to our goalie that they're all kind of getting a bit like, I reckon
that narrative is a bit perpetuated by the by the TV though, because you know what happens. As soon as we concede a corner, there's a close up like inches away from Vicario's face, in the same way they used to do it with David De Gea in his first season at Man United.
And they definitely play on it.
And the more they keep telling us that he's going to be nervous, then it just enters into the subconscious a little bit, where I'm not actually sure whether it happens or not. I always feel like this is one of those things that, like Milo, I know you've read Soconomics, and there's always the talk about corners, like fans, you know, there's a big roar goes up when your team gets a corner. Yeah. And I always know from playing football, if you're actually on the pitch yourself, you always feel like you're going to defend a corner. But each time you become slightly more removed from that, so even like being a sub, which I spent a lot of time at, like playing Saturday afternoon football, you're on the side and then you feel slightly less in control of it. Then when you're watching it just as a spectator, even less so. I mean, the worst thing is listening to your team concede a corner on the radio. That's like, you're absolutely convinced you're going to concede a goal then. So it's those different degrees. So I'm sure when Vicario is there and the camera's right in his face and the commentator's saying, oh, he's going to be nervous again now, he's probably thinking, well, no, actually, 97% chance that we're going to clear this.
I'm
going to deal with it.
Yeah, that's right. As long as he's in his head thinking I'm positive about doing my job here, then that's all that matters, really.
Yeah, there's that Mourinho quote, isn't there? There's only one country in the world where they cheer winning a corner, and it's England. I mean, I think Vic is doing pretty well on the whole at defending corners and set pieces. He seems to be taking control of them a bit more. So maybe we can kind of remove a bit of that protection and maybe go back, or, you know, a hybrid, but, you know, closer to what we were doing earlier in the season. And then adjust if there is a problem, I suppose.
I mean, he can't do anything about our defenders letting opposition players have free headers, really, can he? Coming out and collecting it even further than the goal than he does. And sometimes it's awkward for him to do that because, I mean, of the crowding of the other players in front of him. You know, yeah. It's not like you've got a free run at those kind of things. And I suppose that's one reason the opposition do it, isn't it? Because they realise a goalie's got a massive advantage because he can put his arms up in the air and catch the blooming thing, can't he? So I can see why, you know, they don't want a keeper to do that.
Gareth, you noticed a difference in our attacking between the first and second half. Do you want to just talk us through what you saw?
Yeah, I did. I didn't know whether it was just bias of the camera being on the near side or not, but watching it back, I don't think it is. So in the first half, particularly in the first 25 minutes, we had a lot of joy with Udogi, who was on the near side because Spurs were playing from right to left in the first half. Udogi seemed to get a lot of joy playing in that sort of advanced number eight position where he was coming in field, and we kept finding him. So he was involved in the goal, but there were at least three or four other moves where he got involved in similar positions. So it felt like a lot of our best attacks were coming down now with sort of inside left channel in the first half. But in the second half, and again, I watched this back just to confirm it was actually happening, but almost everything came down our right hand side. So there was, the commentators again made quite a few comments about how anonymous Werner seemed to become in the second half. And I guess it was similar to Udogi. I know he popped up right at the end and he had that snapshot that was saved, but we saw very little of him compared to what we saw of Porro. So I actually did a tally of it. So this was looking at attacks into, not just into the final third, but literally into the last 20 yards of the pitch. So effectively from the edge of the penalty area. So we had 14 attacks down our right-hand side. So in that little quadrant between the sort of width of the six-yard box and the touchline, 14 on the right-hand side, but only three on the left. And two of those were right in the last 5 minutes. And equally, there were only three in central areas, which did kind of back up my thought that we were attacking in a bit of a horseshoe, or at least West Ham were forcing us to do that. But it was, is this field tilt? I can't remember what the statistic is, but certainly it was as if it was like my old Sabutio pitch where you put it on the table and it would just like roll to one side or not. But it felt like the ball was always on that one side of the pitch in both the first and the second half. And I don't know whether that was because at half time, like West Ham consciously blocked those channels out on the left and therefore we had to play on the right or not.
I mean, I had a look at it, so after you mentioned it to me earlier on, and I think West Ham have a press trigger with Udogi in the second half, but Bowen is closing him down very quickly. I think Bowen is a lot more aggressive towards him in the second half. I had a look at the touches for Udogi in the first and second half, and he's got more touches in our half than he had. You know, he's playing deeper, or his touch of the ball are deeper than they were in the first half. I also had a look at Maddison, and Maddison is drawn over to the right a lot more in the second half than he was in the first. And I don't know whether that's him getting drawn towards the ball or whether that's where we were deciding to play. I'm not sure, you know, whether it's, you know, cause or effect, effectively, Maddison. I think you're right, Gareth. I think there is something there between the two halves. And also bringing on Deki isn't going to help because he's naturally going to go to that side of the pitch as well, isn't he?
Yeah, well, I mean, Maddison, I guess, because what became really apparent is the way that we try and score goals, it's that same route. It's trying to create a 2v1 in wide areas where you create the opportunity to pull a ball back across the six-yard box. And that was almost a frustration for me, that it seemed like we were so intent on trying to create that one specific situation that we were overlooking other situations in central areas of the pitch. But to create those 2v1 situations or even 3v1 situations, you need to get your link passes in there, which is where I guess Maddison would come into his own. So it makes sense that you get him onto that side of the pitch so he can play off a one touch pass to someone, a third player, whether it's Porro or Sar when he's come on. We've seen him getting into those positions, and of course Johnson naturally gets into those positions as well.
And all three of those players you're talking about there all play on the right hand side.
Yeah. So whether it was whether it was just at half time, they thought, look, this is how we're going to score goals. We just need to be better at doing it. And if we try and do this like 10 times, one of them's going to come off, and that will be the difference between us is getting the win tonight or not. But it certainly felt like there was a bit of an over-reliance on practicing that one particular manoeuvre.
I'm bouncing this on you, Ricky, a bit, but any thoughts on this?
Sorry, mate. Sorry, I was on mute there. I didn't have much to say anyway, really, so that was probably a good thing to be on. No, I've got nothing to add, really. I agree with, I mean, I trust what you're saying is correct there. I mean, the only thing I said was that it may be, rather flippantly, maybe Ange likes the play to be on his side of the pitch, so it's closer to him. So he can, like, yell at people a bit more and they can hear him. But, yeah, I suppose the plus point of being on the right side, if it breaks down on our side, it's a longer ball for them to find Bowen on the other side. So, you know, because I think he's their main threat, basically, at the end of the day. That right?
He is, yeah, but then Kudus isn't bad either, is he?
And no, he isn't actually. He's quite a good signing for them, yeah.
And, I mean, talking of perceptions, though, I always find whenever I watch a game at West Ham, it always reminds me of watching games when Bayern Munich used to play in the Olympic Stadium. The pitch seems incredibly long and it has no width whatsoever, which I'm sure it can only be down to the camera angles. So that perception of there not being much width anyway, or being able to play from one side of the pitch to the other quickly, is really accentuated at that stadium when you're watching games there.
The thing that occurred to me about the stadium, so they've got the fireworks on the touchline before kickoff, and only in that stadium are the supporters a safe distance away from the fireworks for them to be able to do that. Yeah, anywhere else you'd be singeing your eyebrows.
Yeah, the only stadium health and safety will sign off on it, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. as we're talking about them, what did you think of West Ham?
I think I probably said this last year when we played them. West Ham are just West Ham, aren't they, at the end of the day? They pretty much, I mean, they've got the same manager, so they're going to like churn out that same kind of like system they play. You know, some weeks they don't do well, but most of the time against us, obviously, they're going to like turn up for the game, I think. Pakatar's a great player. I'm not quite sure what's happened with his betting ban. That seems to have gone very quiet. So I thought.
Do you have a bet about how many times he could barge into Madison and get away with it in this game?
Yeah. So. Yeah. No, that's right. But he does get all over the pitch. Fair play to him. And then Bowen's obviously a really good player as well. I think it's a wide man that works hard and is going to contribute. And I think he's played through the middle as well and got goals for them. He's another player that makes the very best of his abilities. But overall for them, I mean, they've got a big stadium and everything, and they've got some income that goes with that. But I just can't see them taking a step like we have into like higher kind of, you know, beyond. I don't think they can break into that next level. I don't think really. But having said that, they're on an upward curve or in a higher place than they probably were for many years. So I can't, you know, I won't criticise them too much as a team. That is, I'm not saying about their fans.
Gareth, what do you think?
Well, because it was so fresh in my memory that they'd got absolutely humiliated by Arsenal not that long ago, it really took me by surprise to hear the statistic that they'd only lost one. That was the only one in about 15 home games that they'd lost. But they're in this comfortable position now where they can put all their eggs in the basket of the Europa League. I know they're playing Leverkusen next, which will obviously be the biggest test they're likely to have in that competition this year. But they seem to have a bit of a know-how in that competition to the extent that they can phone it in a little bit in the league, so they'll get funny results. I mean, I know it's a cliche, but they definitely do add 10% to their performance when they play against us. Like they did yesterday. They've got some decent players. Like as Ricky said, I think they're probably going to struggle to punch above the ceiling they're in at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I thought attacking wise, I thought it was had some similar ideas to Fulham, where every time they got the ball, they were playing out wide, and then they were trying to outnumber us out there, double up. And, partly, I suppose that's playing to their strengths. You know, we've talked about Bowen already, but, that long ball out wide and attacking there, and then just clogging, stodging up the middle when they didn't have the ball. I think for all their quality, I was never really nervous in open play with them. I think it felt to me like their only chance of scoring was going to be through a set piece. And, even when it got a bit stretched later in the game, I still felt pretty comfortable about that. I'm disappointed that we didn't win. I thought we were comfortably the better team.
Yeah, I just thought it was a game we really needed to win, bearing in mind the games we've got coming up and the points that I'm predicting that I think we need. We've got away games, it's these middling games against West Ham, Chelsea and Newcastle, and realistically I think we've got to win at least one of those three. So having not won yesterday, it just reduces the wriggle room slightly, and it puts a bit of pressure on us now when we go to Newcastle and whenever we go to Chelsea as well. We're probably gonna have to win one of those. I know, like, you know, Villa have been beaten comfortably tonight, but we will need those points, bearing in mind we've got that horrible run of three games against the top three coming up as well.
One positive, one negative, 30 seconds. Who's going to go first?
I'll go quickly. We might do if I say the same things. The rise of Johnson is my positive. He keeps on improving. That's great. And the negative is just what you said, Milo, really. I thought that was the 3 points that we could have taken, really. West Ham didn't really offer that much, and their threats were well dealt with by our defenders, really. So,
Gareth?
Yeah, positive for me is that Bissouma's really looking the part. I think he's growing in confidence, and I think we probably see him kept in the team now, and then hopefully he can build a bit of momentum up towards the end of the season when we have those really big games, and he could be crucial for us. Negative is what you've already said. What we've already said there. It was 3 points that were there for the taking that we haven't.
My positive is the budding building relationship between Werner and Johnson. It's just really, really fruitful at the moment, and we look a better team with a pair of them in there. And my negative, I suppose, it's going to have to be the same as you. The drop points. That's boring, isn't it? Oh well. let's move on to Luton. So, in a nutshell, what did you think of the performance in the Luton game? Gareth Corbett.
I thought we were okay against Luton. I don't think we were brilliant. I think we were okay. I think Luton scoring the goal first created a bit of a red herring. That didn't really create the game narrative. I think many of us thought we were unfortunate not to have scored. That was a fairly freak incident that where it comes off both posts and then you have two shots blocked on the line immediately afterwards. It's not one that's going to live in the memory long enough, but I think we did more than enough to win that one comfortably. Arsenal have beaten Luton today 2-0 without ever really needing to get out of third gear, and I think ultimately wasn't too different to our game. We'll obviously pull it apart a little bit and look at some of the minutiae, but I think it was a fairly comfortable day in the office.
What do you think, Ricky?
Yeah, similar really. I think, the conceding the early goal is always going to give Luton a kind of uplift in that early moment. So I think they then, I think they're a side full of energy, but I think they are a bit of a, so they will come at you, but I think they're just a bit naive sometimes, I think, Luton. I mean, whether that's because they're a bit of a kind of novice in the Premier League, but I thought they were there for the take-in, and I think we tried... I think some of our passing or our variation of passing was pretty good in this game. And we even tried to play some sort of slightly longer stuff, and it just wasn't going in for us. And I'm not saying we missed a host of chances, but there were certainly some moments where you just thought, well, the one Gareth referenced, and I think there was another, well, that one that crossed the line but didn't, and all those kind of things. But it was just some moments where, so it was just a relief when Sonny managed to get us over the line, another one. But I mean, I suppose in a roundabout way, it was, another close game that maybe didn't need to be close, but they seem to be, what we have these days, really.
Yeah, but I mean, if both of those kind of goal line huggers go in and it's 4-1, that doesn't feel, that doesn't feel out of place compared to the game, I don't think. I think if it ended up 4-1, I don't think anyone would say we were lucky to get that. I thought we were pretty good in this game. I think, everything that we do well, we were doing. And, it just didn't quite get the rub of the green, it felt to me.
Yeah.
So Dragosan got his second start in succession. How do you think he's settling into the team? And was his performance an improvement on Fulham?
Played slightly out of position, wasn't he, having to play on the left in a game where both of our central defenders were going to have lots of the ball. It looked a little bit clunky. Mm-hmm. I think he got better as the game went on, but he always had that tendency. As any right footer, you could have put Romero on that side. I think he would have had exactly the same issue, that instinctively he's going to want to bring the ball back onto his right foot rather than playing on his left. It's not going to be the biggest test of him defensively, is it? So it's hard to read too many definitive conclusions at this point. But I think ultimately when he will shine for us, it'll be when he's playing on the right, on his more natural side.
Yeah, I think he had a pretty... I think he was better than he was against Fulham, but then there was not much for him to sort of shine doing, really, because it's just quite an average kind of game for him. He wasn't asked to do much, and he didn't have... I mean, as I said, I think that's why he was selected as well, because we didn't need Van de Ven, because Morris isn't very quick for them up front. So, you know, there wasn't going to be any kind of... chasing that needed to go on. And as yes, most of the time it's going to be us controlling the game and him receiving balls from Romero and back. I think sometimes he does turn around a bit and go back to Vicario sometimes when maybe he doesn't need to. But I mean, that's really small stuff, really. I mean, the one thing slightly disappointing with him at the moment is I thought he might be... I don't think he's really come anywhere near with an attacking header at a corner yet, has he?
No.
And I think that was one thing he was touted for, to be like a bit of a monster in the air. So hopefully he might... add that in future games when he gets a run.
Yeah, he scored a few headers from set pieces for Genoa.
He has,
I mean, I don't know, I got a bit of pushback around my comments on him on the Fulham game. I think maybe I just wasn't clear about what I was saying. I think, you know, I think as a one-on-one defender, I like him. I think he's good at that. I think my criticism around, and I agree with you're saying, Gareth, about him being very one-footed. I think his first touch isn't great either. And that narrows his passing options. And when I'm talking about that, mainly I'm talking about kind of when we're building out from the back, how we build attacks. And if you look at kind of average positions and passing kind of volume, we get him in the side, it becomes quite lopsided and you don't get those passes out to the left. I think in this game, both Maddison and Udogi were dropping deeper in order to help him and give him some easier balls, easier passes. Mm. But he's still very, very heavily towards passing towards the right and allowing Romero to do the work. And I'm not convinced that's going to be any better on the right, because I just, although the more natural balls are on, I don't think he's ever going to be a great passer, because I just don't think his touch is great, and I don't think he's really got that kind of vision. But on the plus side, I thought his ball carrying, the couple of times he went upfield, looked really good, and I think he's better than what we had before for Ange. And although he's not as quick as Van de Ven, he's still pretty quick, and he allows us to play the high line, which is why we weren't seeing Dyer play it earlier in the season, because he just wouldn't be able to deal with it. And for all my criticism on the ball, he's better on the ball than Sanchez was. So, I think he's new in the league. He's still quite young. There's obviously going to be a settling period. He's going to get, he is going to improve. He is going to get better. But the things I think he's not quite so good at, I think are always going to be there. It's just, the other stuff is, whether that's enough. But I mean, I like him. I'd say for all the negatives around his passing, I like him. I think he's a decent player. He's a decent addition, but it means we desperately need to sign a left centre back in the summer, I think, in order to try and kind of compensate for that, because I'd be worried if he was getting a run in that position.
Mm. I mean, it does make you wonder if Ange, with Ange and his philosophy, whether he will say to Dragusan, look, I want you to make these passes, just play them, keep playing and keep playing them. If you give it away, because that's what he's implied before, isn't it? In other words, I'll take the rap for that. I want you to do something. And whether some player might blossom a bit because they've been given that confidence and then realise they're actually good at it. I mean, I know some players just seem more naturally good at that. I mean, Romero being an example, or John Stone or someone like that, they seem to have that kind of natural thing. And whether it's an I suppose it depends what percentage those passes are, whether you really are asking someone to thread a needle or whether you're just saying, look, I'm a bit fed up with you just playing sideways. Can you at least, find someone that's a bit ahead of you kind of thing?
I mean, Van de Ven's not the best passer. It's not his strength, but he's got a couple of decent balls. I mean, obviously he's playing, he's left footed. So that helps that side of the pitch is open to him. But, I don't think you necessarily have to be the best passer. I mean, you'd probably, again, I think there's probably a concern for, Dragusin and Van de Ven together, and whether, how that affects our build up play, if and when that happens.
But I suppose there's a, a little caution from a new player in himself, thinking, I don't want to bodge up, because, you know. So it might take a while for that Ange message to get through to say, look, I don't really care if you bodge up. I want you to do this, and hopefully we'll get to that destination. So we've just got to, like, work through that kind of thing. But
And it really is exposed, or the perhaps the lack of ability on the ball is exposed by how good Romero is. The amount of times over the last couple of games, and obviously I'm in the stadium, you can see it slightly better. But even on the game last night on the TV, I remember one down by the corner flag, Romero, it looked like he misplaced a clearance. And then the camera pans back and it's gone to a Spurs player in about 10 yards of space. So I think whoever's going to play, that's the benchmark level that you want central defenders to get to now into their passing range.
But the problem is, I mean, Romero's exceptional. You know, he's controlling our game from centre-back.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about it during the game last night. I think for me at the moment, he'd be my player of the season. I think he's barely put a foot wrong since, since he came back from...
And what a foot wrong that was.
Yeah, it was. But I think since then, he's been spot on. And his levels are just so, so high.
Yeah. It's similar to us wanting people to put the ball in the net like Kane and Son, really, isn't it? You know what I mean? Yeah. We don't realise that they're just absolutely brilliant at it. And it's the same with Romero's passing. He's so relaxed and quite often just has his foot on top of the ball looking, doesn't he? And the odd bit of pointing, and then he'll just fire something in and it'll be dead accurate. It's a great thing to watch.
Ange said after the game that he was happy with the performance overall. I think actually we probably just said the same, haven't we? You know, he's happy with the chances we were creating. Do you think people are focusing too much on the first halves? And, you know, there's a narrative, people are looking for it now because of, you know, we've had a few stodgy first halves. Do you think that's become a truism?
I mean, generally the second halves have been better than the first halves. I think that is a truth. I think the other thing that our supporter base reacts to unnaturally is what's going on with Arsenal at the moment. And I think that any perceived failings of us are really accentuated by what they're doing at the moment. And I think if Arsenal were sort of having a Chelsea or even a Man United season at the moment, we wouldn't be quite so quick to jump on it. I think we're so desperate to be at that top table and competing at that highest level again at the moment that the benchmark is set so high that it's really warping, you know, actual realities of where we should be and what we should be doing at the moment.
I think I said a few weeks ago that we used to be very good at the fast starts. We used to come really out the traps quite quickly. And I think once again, people get used to that. And I mean, I like that because I think it sets the tempo of the game and it sets things on fire quite early. But I think we've had a few games where we've been a bit more in a bit more of a kind of technical boxer mode where we're just kind of feeling out what we're doing and then go and being a bit slower. That not necessarily massively slow. I mean, as I say, I mean, I think West Ham first half, we was all right. We set into that kind of pattern and rhythm. I don't think we were particularly like blitzing them or anything. And I think that actually can be effective, but we just don't seem to be doing that as much at the moment. And I was just going to mention, I think also with fast starts, I don't think we're particularly pressing as well as we were before. I think we do... Like Son will go after someone sometimes and then the next person isn't really predicting. Well, normally you'd train this, but normally you'd predict where that person's option is to pass it then. And then you'd be sort of after that person, after that other next opposition player. And we kind of do it a bit individually when I think earlier in the season, we really were getting after teams. And that was kind of part of setting that tempo early in the game, really. Because I've watched some other teams recently. I suppose talking about Arsenal, maybe another team, but they seem really coordinated in their press. As though it's just second nature to them. And I'm not saying they're going about it like manically all the time, but it at least seems quite effective. And I don't know whether that's because of our energy levels have dropped or whether we've got some slightly different people in the team sometimes, or I don't know what it is. But I mean, it's not massively detrimental, but I just think it goes towards us. I think pressing on one side of the ball and then attacking quickly in transition or when you get it is all part of playing at a pace. And I just don't think we're necessarily doing that as much. I mean, it's not detrimental, really. It's just maybe a slightly different way of playing sometimes or managing the minutes in a slightly different way, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I think people are focusing on the first half a little bit too much. I think, well, certainly getting angsty about it. I'd say I wasn't at the game on Saturday, but I was kind of following it online, and certainly I saw quite a lot of overreaction to the first half, and you know, very negative comments about it. And I thought we played pretty well. And I don't know whether there's people kind of judging the scoreline rather than the performance, or just, you know, frustration that not every attack's coming off. But I do think, you know, again, part of this tactic is to try and wear down teams and create chances and pull them around. And then, you know, when we get, you know, if it's working really well, you wear a team down and then you score goals in quick succession, you know, kind of that Villa performance, you know, yeah, game, and you know, Palace as well, wasn't it, where we scored in very, very quick succession, and that's the system working very well, the tactics working well. And I think we're going to have to get used to that. And you know, I think that is, you know, part of the plan is to do that.
Yeah, well, I've to make the point that it's really dangerous to start your analysis of a game from the result and then work your way backwards, which I see lots of like journalists and professionals doing, let alone supporters and bloke in the pub doing it. I think you can get sucked into doing that at half time, and I know I certainly have as well, and you could probably pull out messages that I've sent on WhatsApp of various half time games as well, where you think, well, we're losing 1-0, so therefore it's got to have been absolutely awful and we've been terrible going forward and really loose at the back. But you're only halfway through the story at that point, and you need the perception of the full 100 minutes now, and even then you've got to be careful you don't start from the result and work your way back, because that often gives you a very, very different narrative than if you go from front whistle forward. As strange as it is to say, the actual scoreline is one of almost an infinite number of ways of judging which team's playing well and which one isn't. Unfortunately, it's the only one that ultimately counts at the end of it. But there are so many different ways, and sometimes the score, particularly at half time when you're only 50% of the way through a game, is it really can create a bit of a red herring.
Yeah. Let's move on to something happier then. So Sonny passed Cliff Jones in our all-time record goal scorers list with his 86th minute winner. We put him on 160 goals. Martin Chivers is at number four on the list with 14 more goals than Sonny. And then obviously against West Ham, he made his 400th appearance. So he's the kind of records are falling for him this week. He's pretty much guaranteed to pass Big Chiv, isn't he?
Yeah, I'm just trying to work out whether he'd do it this season, but I think he'd have to go on a real streak to do it this season. It's more likely it will happen by probably about October, November time.
I thought so, yeah.
Next season.
Yeah.
I mean, it's remarkable, really, for a player who spent most of that time out on the wing. Obviously, I know the player he's just passed also did that, but and so quickly after kind of Kane breaking all these records as well, it just feels really special to have another player, you know, so, you know, doing the same, so, you know, so close together. Just how lucky we are to have had them.
I mean, if you probably look across the leagues and, you know, European leagues and across the last decade, it really is elite level stuff when you think about it. It's probably, I mean, he's probably similar contribution to us to what Salah has for Liverpool, really, playing more as a wide kind of person. And of course, we get so much else from Sonny as a package as well, with the kind of the way he's an ambassador for the club. And, you know, no one will say really ever a bad word about him, and the way he kind of brings people together. And of course, probably the best smile in football. We haven't mentioned that one for a while, have we? So, he's probably got a few years left, because, you know, I think he looks after himself immaculately. And, and I think, you know, his dad probably makes sure he does that. So, so he probably wants as many years out of his son as well. And, you know, that's for no other reason, probably because he just thinks he's an absolute, you know, to have a son like Son, he's just like, you know, off the charts for, like, you know, as a dad. So, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a, he's my favourite. I think he's my favourite all-time player. I love him. Absolutely love him.
Yeah, when he comes back in all those years, in 10, 20 years, it's just going to get such a good reception every time when he comes back to White Hart Lane, I think. You know, he's one of those ones that, you know, in fact, he'll probably be very similar to Cliff Jones himself, because everyone absolutely loves Cliff Jones as well, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He's just such a gentleman.
He'll still be running out into the pitch on his 80th birthday, as Cliff Jones did a couple of years ago as the halftime guest. And
he's amazing.
Doing press ups well into his 80s as well. And I don't know, I'm taking over here, Milo, but it's probably a quite good segue because I wonder whether Sonny's grandson will one day be
a coach.
Yeah, a coach and featuring on Off the Shelf.
Yeah.
It's a good cue to move on to the week that was. We'll start off with the financial results that for the year 22-23 that were released earlier today. It's Wednesday. The headline is we reported a loss of 86.8 million. I'll just rattle through these figures and then ask you what you think, Ricky. So revenues increased 24% from 444 million in 21-22 to 549.6 million. It's the first time we've brought in more than half a billion. Match receipts, were up. So it's 117.6 million up from 106.1 million the previous year. UEFA prize money was 56.2 million up from 10.2 million, but not really a good comparison there because that was the financial year being reported. We reached the last 16 of the Champions League. The year before that is a COVID Europa Conference season. TV and media revenue were up so it's 148.1 million up from 144.2. Part of that's just down to the new TV deal. Commercial revenues, 227.7 million up from 183.5 million. So that's kind of sponsorship, merchandising, events, visitor attractions, conferences, events, and all that kind of stuff. Operating expenses before football trading rose by 21% to 487.9 million for 403.4 million. So this is kind of increased team costs, hosting of non-football events and cost rises outside of our control. So like utilities, rates, all that kind of stuff, which I think is kind of the stuff the club were alluding to when they put up the prices recently. So wages are up 20%. Profit from operations before depreciation, amortization, player trading, interest and taxation increased from 138.7 million to, from 112.3 million. But the loss for the year after depreciation and amortization, player trading and interest and taxation rose. So that was, as I said earlier on, 86.8 million from 501 million the previous year. Which the club have said reflected the significant continued investment in the playing squad. So our net debt at 30th of June, which is the end of the financial year, was 677.4 million, which was up from 626.1 million. And say in the accounts, it says that over 90% of our financial borrowings of 851.2 million are at fixed rates with an average interest rate of 2.79. I've just renewed my mortgage this week. I wish I was getting that. The average maturity on all our borrowings is 19.4. I shouldn't laugh. Average maturity on all our borrowings is 19.4 years, some of which stretch to 2051. As with prior years, no dividends have been paid. And probably what's going to get the headlines is that Daniel Levy admitted that the club are in talks with potential investors, saying to capitalise on our long-term potential, to continue to invest in the team and undertake future capital projects, the club requires a significant increase in its equity base. The board and its advisors, Rothschild and Co., are in discussions with prospective investors. Any recommended investment proposal will be required to the support of the club's shareholders. What do you make of this, Ricky?
Well, it shows that the machine is working as it should, I think. It's all probably fine and dandy. I mean, just quickly on that debt thing, I think our gross debt is still just remains at about, gross debt is about 850 million, which I think is costing us about 25 million in interest to service every year. And that's probably not going to be reduced because we've got those long-term interest rates that are obviously doing us great favours at the moment. We've lucked out there massively, to be honest. The one thing I will pick up on is the losses thing, is people who lose their shit over losses saying, oh, how have we made like 87 million a loss? Because 72 million of that is depreciation on the stadiums. That's not actually like a physical loss. That's just where we depreciate in the stadium every year. And I think if I expand that out to 3 years, I think that we've lost 232 million, but 216 of that is depreciation of the stadium. So, and what that relates to is there's no problems with PSR because that loss has got nothing to do with PSR calculations. So we haven't lost that much at all. And the other reason we'll depreciate the stadium is because you don't want to make a profit as a football team. Otherwise, you just, like, if we made 100 million profit, you'd pay 25% of that in corporation tax to the government. And what is the point of that? There's just no point doing that. So people think that, well, how come we've got all this money and now we're making a loss? But a lot of it is just depreciation of the stadium, and people kind of need to understand that. So there's no kind of like problems with that there. I think the other thing to note is, transfers wise now, I think in these accounts is only Madison and Vicario. I think that's they right. said so. And I think that basically leaves for next year. I think Phillips, Van der Ven, Villiers, Brennan Johnson, plus the Porro and Decky loans being made permanent. And then in January, you got Dragusan. So I think what that indicates is, because what you've got to remember is next year is we've got no UEFA money at all. And I think that's another thing to point out, as you referenced, Milo, is the big difference between depending what tournament you're in there. I mean, that's almost, I think, 40-something plus million, which is, you know, if you're in the Champions League or in the Conference League. So it shows how important it is to be in that competition. And of course, as I say, next year we've got none of that income from UEFA at all. So I think that probably leads to thinking that leads into why it was quite important that we did sell Harry Kane, really, because not only have we got big money for him, I think on three fronts. I think one, that really does sort us out completely for PSR for the next God knows how many years, because we're going to have banked 100% profit of £100 million. So we got no issues with that going forward. I think also some of that money was quite heavily front loaded, wasn't it, that fee? We got quite a lot of money up front from Bayern. So that's kind of oiled, I think the report said that, I think that's oiled the wheels of next year, where we've had quite a few purchases in that year, plus no UEFA money. And the other thing is, I think that really goes to show, and I think obviously Chelsea are doing this to a certain degree, shows how important the academy is, and like we develop that academy, because if we get any players from them, and Chelsea are literally relying on the Mount money, the Gallagher money, the Rhys James money and that kind of thing, because that really helps you bank that straight away. So then your PSL numbers are kind of okay. As for the Levy thing, as in, I think honestly, it wouldn't surprise me if Levy's thinking, I've done what I can, and the upside of getting more out of this machine is not really that easy, because I think some upsides would be, he can't rely on the TV deal going up anymore, really. He might do, that might happen, but he can't control that. I think we've got more, one thing is, I think we've got permission from Harrogate now for more events. Is that, I think that's correct, isn't it? Aren't we up to 30 now? I think that might have been agreed.
We've certainly put in for it. I don't know whether it's been agreed. I mean, the one thing we have got agreement on is the hotel. So planning permission was granted this week for the 180-room hotel with 50 private apartments behind the South Stand. So that's going to start soon. Maybe that's one of the things they're looking for. Well, I mean, they'll have a partner for that, won't they? That probably wouldn't require much up front.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting he said in that thing that it's for, and I wasn't sure whether he was being completely sincere, but he says it's for like a squad improvements and infrastructure. Yeah. When I thought he maybe threw both those things in to make sure that, you know, it didn't sound just like infrastructure, but also it sounded like I'm still interested in investing as much as I can in the squad. But where more money's going to come from, as in from just what exists at the moment, I think it's safe to say that the finance or lending line from Joe Lewis is obviously over because he's not part of it anymore. And to be honest, he probably did quite well getting 150 million out of Joe Lewis like a few seasons ago. I think a financial institution will never lend you money to buy players. That's a guarantee. Mm-hmm. There's just too much. There's no, this is completely a risky thing. And also financial institutions aren't going to give him the interest rates that we've secured at other times. So the way forward is to either a share issue to expand our capital and then get someone else on board, or him and Enoch sell part of their actual equity themselves to a new investor that comes in. But on that point, I'm not quite sure who would make that decision on Enoch's part, if you see what I mean, because is it just held in a trust now and things like that? So I'm not quite sure whether that's just sitting there until the beneficiaries, you know, because we don't know Joe Lewis's situation. I know it's been signed over, but I presume, I don't know whether that's, I mean, speculation.
It's his
whether
daughter, isn't it?
All been well, whether that trust has been developed for succession planning and all that kind of thing, I presume it is, because, you know, Joe Lewis is not young anymore, kind of thing. So if we want to sell some equity from that, I'm not quite sure. As you say, it might be his daughter, or there might be more complicated because it's held in a trust and everyone has to agree, kind of thing. But I'm thinking that's where he's seeing more money will come from to invest more in the squad side, and because we could be maxing out our channels already. You know what I mean? We could be, you know, as I say, more money can only come from doing better in Europe. More events, match day is going to be hard to really increase because, you know, I don't think the fans should be paying more for match day, and we've seen that they're going to be to a slight degree, which I can understand why they've put prices up, but I think on the bigger picture, I don't think they should find that from fans, really. I think we're on a high price already, and I think the amount they're getting from fans isn't worth the kind of bad PR or the pain for every 40,000 of those individual fans, really. But yeah, I mean, things, I mean, we don't, I mean, people always criticize that, oh yeah, we don't get no prizes for financial things. But if people, if you had someone running your finances in your own house like this, you'd be very pleased. And I think in the last few days, if you want to look at what poor planning or poor decision making is, I think Everton and Leicester have both revealed their results in the last few days. And that's quite a stark contrast, really.
And I've just seen that Chelsea are late. They're late filing theirs.
Yeah.
Wonder why.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, one thing is, and this is not another trophy thing, but I did notice that we actually, I mean, this is the other thing next year, is wages will probably come down because we've lost Hugo, Harry, Moura, Perisic and all that kind of thing. So, I mean, I'm not sure what the new boys are on, but...
I did look at this, actually. It more or less balances out. So most of the new guys coming in, there's kind of a higher base level now. So although we've removed a lot of top earners...
Yeah.
The average salary of the squad, I think, has increased.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So,
and there's probably, still a few to shift off that. But of course, shifting players is not easy either. I think I did actually notice that, I think we're actually, this won't be good for some people's ears, but I think we've actually, because of we're not getting those good results, but I think actually our wage bill is bigger than Arsenal's for the first time as well.
It is, yeah.
This year.
It is.
So, yeah.
Let's move on. So Richarlison gave a very open and honest interview with ESPN last week where he talked about his mental health, depression and how he thought about giving up football after the World Cup. I mean, I thought it was an incredibly brave interview. And as a society, and men in particular, we find it difficult to talk about mental health. And although thankfully, I think that's changing a little. I won't tell you that it's an easy watch, but I would encourage you to seek it out and to watch it. I mean, I think he's just been really brave. I don't know what you guys think.
Yeah, very brave. And he, I mean, he's built on an interview he gave. I can't remember when it was. It was after one of their international breaks. And I think the point that was made then that he even made it was there were members of his family that didn't particularly believe in mental health or suffering from mental health. So this goes far deeper than it just being a well-known professional footballer using a platform to talk about it. This is probably exercising demons that he's had for many years, and hopefully this makes his family ties stronger as well, and it helps not just people feel confident talking about their mental health, but hopefully it gives other people more confidence in being able to listen to family members and friends who might want to share any challenges they're having with their mental health as well. So I see it as a win-win. This is definitely a professional footballer using a platform and their fame and notoriety to really good use. And good luck to him.
Yeah, I mean, that's the main point that I took out of it was I think people were thinking, oh, he's come forward and he's spoken out and he's brave to do that in a kind of football sense. But I think football for very many years now has been a lot more open to sending the mental health messages. And there's all the support there. I mean, around at our club, I'm sure there's people and therapists and qualified people that he can talk to. And I think that was the main point, like Gareth said. I think it was because in his own environment, his own close friends, his Brazilian background. I mean, I'm not privy to how things, you know, in the way things work in that kind of country. And also, obviously, there's very levels in that country as well when it comes to, status and wealth and that kind of thing. And from the areas he came from, that's where it kind of started in our country quite often. I mean, through the kind of more working class things, the talk of mental health was just a massive, massive no-no and a sign of weakness and all those kind of things. And I'm sure Richie might have felt those things himself. Even if he was perceiving that himself, it just stopped him opening that release valve and then speaking about things and talking about things. And ironically, I don't know, I mean, you know, speculation, but maybe his parents and that really empathized with him when he did speak about it. Because sometimes you can manifest this stuff in your head as well, yourself, just thinking, oh, I can't talk about that. I'm like, especially I'm assuming he's the big breadwinner of the family as well. So, you know, he's probably thinks I have to be like the strong person and that within the family. And I knew he had trouble with his agent and all those kind of things. And that might have been what led to some of this. And he found it just difficult to talk about or deal with, really. Because I mean, the other thing we always forget is, I mean, you think he's like the big, strong centre half, but he's not very old, is he? I mean, these people are still quite young when you think about it. And, you know, your the strength of your mind, your brain, and the understanding of things is still very much in the developmental stage, I think, at that age.
So I don't even think it's just supporting his family. I know that he gives a very high proportion of his wages to charity in Brazil and helps people from similar backgrounds to him.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's, he does quite a lot. I think, I really don't think it's an overestimate, an exaggeration to say that he might have saved someone's life talking about this and you know, being willing to speak up. And, you know, we've seen it, a few times. You know, we've spoken about Aaron Lennon before and obviously Delhi, that heartbreaking interview, not too long ago. So, it's good to see, players talking about this and being more open about it. And, I just really, really respect Richie for what he's done. Another interview worth checking out, but for happier reasons, is Matt Wells' interview on Off the Shelf last week. He talks about his playing career that was sadly cut short by injury and how he got into coaching, his early coaching career. And I think what would be of particular interest to listeners to this was, when he talks about working with Ange, the thing that really struck me was he was talking about kind of the training regime. So Ange doesn't really get involved in first team training until later or closer to a game. He leaves it to the coaches earlier in the week. And Matt was saying that we knew already that they did 60-minute training sessions. What Matt said was that they do 15 minutes each coach does 15-minute sessions. And the idea there is to keep up the intensity. And so there's almost competition between the four of them to, you know, kind of do the most intense sessions. You don't want to let the team down. And they're saying then after those sessions, Ange does a kind of post-mortem with them where they go through the session, review it, which players did well, which ones didn't do so well, who was buying into it, and you know, what worked within the session and then how they could improve it. I thought it was really interesting. It was really interesting. He talked about the kind of the relationship, you know, he's had with Ange and how that's worked. Have either of you guys seen it?
I think I saw up to the bit where he was talking about his injury. I didn't, for some reason, I then had to, yeah, sorry.
Go back to it, watch it on.
No, we'll do. I don't know what sidetracked me. I'm not quite sure what sidetracked me, but yeah. Gareth?
No, you haven't seen it yet, have you, Gareth?
No, I haven't seen it yet, but Matt Wells is of interest to me. I've bumped into him a few times over the years. I say socially, I don't know, he's probably too famous to remember my name now, but...
Oh, he goes to your pub quiz, doesn't he?
His family used to come into the pub quiz that I run. So that's where I used to sort of see him occasionally. Had nice family, as I said earlier. He's Cliff Jones's grandson.
Yeah.
So, you know, really sort of bringing in the club ties over multi-generations as well.
Anyway, definitely give it a watch. It's really interesting. And finally, The Athletic and a few other outlets reported last week that scouts Ian Broomfield, Augusto Benito and Colin Jackson are all leaving the club as part of the review and restructuring of our off-field setup that's been going on over the last year or so. Broomfield was at Spurs scout back when Harry Redknapp was manager before leaving in 2013, and then he returned as a senior scout in a position he's held since. Benito's in charge of scouting in Spain and Portugal, and Jackson scouts first team and youth team players in the north of England. Alexandro Sabrizio and Dave Butler are also set to leave. With a move to a more data-led approach, and Scott Munn, Johan Lang and Rob McKenzie all joining the club since last summer, this doesn't really seem much of a surprise, does it, really?
No, I think that's the direction they're going in. It's going to be far more data-led. So, yes.
Yeah. I think the idea would be to kind of filter things out at the hub of the ground, isn't it, really? At the, you know, the nerve centre of the training ground. And then you can send people to go and see these players or, you know, depending on maybe their area of expertise or languages they master might help if they're in conversations. And once a lot more groundwork's done before then, I think, you know, rather than just have people sitting out in various points of the planet Earth, sort of maybe reporting back in on, you know.
Yeah. So my only surprise that we had a scout of Spain and Portugal. Presumably he's been sitting there with his feet up drinking sangria since we signed Brian Hill and had an easy run of it.
Not a bad job.
No. So we'd forgotten about him and I just realised that he's still on the payroll, I think.
Yeah.
Thanks, Les. Right. That was fun.
Cheers, mate.
We'll be back at our normal time this weekend to chat about our game against Nottingham Forest and some other Spurs nonsense. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you then.